This is Audible.
The Farseer, Assassin's Quest, by Robin Hobb. Narrated by Paul Bamer. Copyright 1997 by Robin Hobb. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Robin Hobb, care of Ralph Vicinanza Limited, and was produced in the year 2010 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Prologue. The Unremembered. I awake every morning with ink on my hands. Sometimes I am sprawled face down on my work table, amidst a welter of scrolls and papers. My boy, when he comes in with my tray, may dare to chide me for not taking myself off to bed the night before. But sometimes he looks at my face and ventures no word. I do not try to explain to him why I do as I do. It is not a secret one can give to a younger man. It is one he must earn, and learn on his own. A man has to have a purpose in life. I know this now, but it took me the first score years of my life to learn it. In that, I scarcely think myself unique. Still, it is a lesson that once learned has remained with me. So, with little besides pain with which I occupy myself these days, I have sought out a purpose for myself. I have turned to a task that both Lady Patience and Scribe Fedrin had long ago advocated. I began these pages as an effort to write down a coherent history of the six duchies, but I found it difficult to keep my mind long fixed on a single topic, and so I distract myself with lesser treatises, on my theories of magic, on my observations of political structures, and my reflections on other cultures. When the discomfort is at its worst and I cannot sort my own thoughts well enough to write them down, I work on translations, or attempt to make a legible recording of older documents. I busy my hands in the hope of distracting my mind. My writing serves me as Verity's map-making once served him. The detail of the work and the concentration required is almost enough to make one forget both the longings of the addiction and the residual pains of having once indulged it. One can become lost in such work and forget oneself, or one can go even deeper, and find many recollections of that self. All too often, I find I have wandered far from a history of the duchies into a history of Fitzchivalry. Those recollections leave me face to face with who I once was, and who I have become. When one is deeply absorbed in such a recounting, it is surprising how much detail one can recall. Not all the memories I summon up are painful. I have had more than just a share of good friends, and found them more loyal than I had any right to expect. I have known beauties and joys that tried my heart's strength, as surely as the tragedies and uglinesses have. Yet I possess, perhaps, a greater share of dark memories than most men. Few men have known death in a dungeon, or can recall the inside of a coffin buried beneath the snow. The mind shies away from the details of such things. It is one thing to recall that Regal killed me. It is another to focus on the details of the days and nights endured as he starved me, and then had me beaten to death. When I do, there are moments that still can turn my bowels to ice, even after all these years. I can recall the eyes of the man and the sound of his fist breaking my nose. There still exists for me a place I visit in my dreams, where I fight to remain standing, trying not to let myself think of how I will make a final effort to kill Regal. I recall the blow from him that split my swollen skin and left the scar down my face that I still bear. I have never forgiven myself the triumph I ceded to him, when I took poison and died. But more painful than the events I can recall are those that are lost to me. When Regal killed me, I died. I was never again commonly known as Fitzchivalry. I never renewed bonds to the Buckkeep folk who had known me since I was a child of six. I never lived in Buckkeep Castle again, never more waited on the Lady Patience, never sat on the hearthstones at Chade's feet again. Lost to me were the rhythms of lives that had intertwined with mine. Friends died. Others were wed. Babes were born. Children came of age, and I saw none of it. Though I no longer possess the body of a healthy young man, many still live who once called me friend. Sometimes still. I long to rest eyes on them, to touch hands, to lay to peace the loneliness of years. I cannot. Those years are lost to me, and all the years of their lives to come. Lost, too, is that period, no longer than a month, but seeming much longer, when I was confined to a dungeon, and then coffin. My king had died in my arms, yet I did not see him buried. Nor was I present at the council after my death when I was found guilty of having used the wit magic, and hence deserving the death that had been dealt me. Patience came to lay claim to my body. My father's wife, once so distressed to discover he had sired a bastard before they were wed, was the one who took me from that cell. Hers, the hands that washed my body for burial, that straightened my limbs and wrapped me in a grave-cloth. Awkward, eccentric Lady Patience, for whatever reason, cleansed my wounds and bound them as carefully as if I still lived. She alone ordered the digging of my grave, and saw to the burying of my coffin. She and Lacey, her woman, mourned me, when all others, out of fear or disgust at my crime, abandoned me. Yet she knew nothing of how Burrich and Chade, my assassin mentor, came nights later to that grave, and dug away the snow that had fallen and the frozen clumps of earth that had been tossed down on my coffin. Only those two were present as Burrich broke through the lid of the coffin and tugged out my body. And then, summoned, by his own wit magic, the wolf that had been entrusted with my soul. They wrested that soul from the wolf, and sealed it back into the battered body it had fled. They raised me, to walk once more in a man's shape, to recall what it was to have a king and be bound by an oath. To this day, I do not know if I thank them for that. Perhaps, as the fool insists, they had no choice. Perhaps there can be no thanks, nor any blame, but only recognition of the forces that brought us and bound us to our inevitable fates. 1. Grave birth. In the Chalcid states, slaves are kept. They supply the drudge labor. They are the miners, the bellows workers, the galley rowers, the crews for the offal wagons, the field workers, and the whores. Oddly, slaves are also the nursemaids and children's tutors and cooks and scribes and skilled craftsfolk. All of the Chalcid's gleaming civilization, from the great libraries of Jep to the fabled fountains and baths of Sinjans, is founded on the existence of a slave class. The Bingtown traders are the major source of the slave supply. At one time, most slaves were captives taken in war, and Chalcid still officially claims this is true. In more recent years, there have not been sufficient wars to keep up with the demand for educated slaves. The Bingtown traders are very resourceful in finding other sources, and the rampant piracy of the trade islands is often mentioned in association with this. Those who are slave owners in Chalcid show little curiosity about where the slaves come from, so long as they are healthy. Slavery is a custom that has never taken root in the Six Duchies, A man convicted of a crime may be required to serve the one he has injured, but a limit of time is always placed, and he is never seen as less than a man making atonement. If a crime is too heinous to be redeemed by labor, then the criminal pays with his death. No one ever becomes a slave in the six duchies, nor do our laws support the idea that a household may bring slaves into the kingdom and have them remain so. For this reason, many chalced slaves who do win free of their owners by one path or another often seek the six duchies as a new home. These slaves bring with them the far-flung traditions and folklore of their own lands. One such tale I have preserved has to do with a girl who was vechi, or what we would call witted. She wished to leave her parents' home, to follow a man she loved and be his wife. Her parents did not find him worthy and denied her permission. When they would not let her go, she was too dutiful a child to disobey them, but she was also too ardent a woman to live without her true love. She lay down on her bed and died of sorrow. Her parents buried her with great mourning and much self-reproach that they had not allowed her to follow her heart. But unbeknownst to them, she was wit-bonded to a she-bear, and when the girl died, the she-bear took her spirit into her keeping so it might not flee the world. 3 nights after the girl had been buried, the she-bear dug up the grave and restored the girl's spirit to her body. The girl's grave birth made her a new person, no longer owing duty to her parents. So she left the shattered coffin and went seeking her one true love. The tale has a sad ending, for having been a she-bear for a time, she was never wholly human again, and her true love would not have her. The scrap of a tale was a basis for Burrich's decision to try to free me from Prince Regal's dungeon by poisoning me. The room was too hot and too small. Panting no longer cooled me. I got up from the table and went to the water barrel in the corner. I took the cover off it and drank deeply. Part of the pack looked up with an almost snarl. "Use the cup, Fitz." Water ran from my chin. I looked up at him steadily, watching him. "Wipe your face." Heart of the pack looked away from me, back to his own hands. He had grease on them and was rubbing it into some straps. I snuffed it. I licked my lips. "I am hungry," I told him.
"Sit down and finish your work. Then we will eat."
I tried to remember what he wanted of me. He moved his hand toward the table and I recalled. More leather straps at my end of the table. I went back and sat in the hard chair. "I am hungry now," I explained to him. He looked at me again in the way that did not show his teeth, but was still a snarl. Heart of the pack could snarl with his eyes. I sighed. The grease he was using smelled very good. I swallowed. Then I looked down. Leather straps and bits of metal were on the table before me. I looked at them for a while. After a time, Heart of the Pack set down his straps and wiped his hands on a cloth. He came to stand beside me, and I had to turn to be able to see him.
"Here," he said, touching the leather before me. "You were mending it here."
He stood over me until I picked it up again. I bent to sniff it, and he struck my shoulder.
"Don't do that."
My lip twitched, but I did not snarl. Snarling at him made him very, very angry. For a time I held the straps. Then it seemed as if my hands remembered before my mind did. I watched my fingers work the leather. When it was done, I held it up before him and tugged it hard to show that it would hold even if the horse threw its head back. "But there isn't a horse," I remembered out loud. "All the horses are gone."
"Brother?"
"I come." I rose from my chair. I went to the door.
"Come back and sit down," Heart of the Pack said. Night Eyes waits, I told him. Then I remembered he could not hear me. I thought he could if he would try, but he would not try. I knew that if I spoke to him that way again, he would push me. He would not let me speak to Night Eyes that way much. He would even push Night Eyes if the wolf spoke too much to me. It seemed a very strange thing. Night Eyes waits, I told him with my mouth.
I know.
It is a good time to hunt now.
It is a better time for you to stay in. I have food for you here.
Night Eyes and I could find fresh meat.
My mouth ran at the thought of it. A rabbit torn open, still steaming in the winter night. That was what I wanted. Night Eyes will have to hunt alone this night.
Heart of the Pack told me. He went to the window and opened the shutters a little. The chill air rushed in. I could smell Night Eyes and, farther away, a snow cat. Night Eyes whined.
Go away,
Heart of the Pack told him.
Go on now, go hunt, go feed yourself. I've not enough to feed you here.
Night Eyes went away from the light that spilled from the window, but he did not go too far. He was waiting out there for me. But I knew he could not wait long. Like me, he was hungry now. Heart of the Pack went to the fire that made the room too hot. There was a pot by it, and he poked it away from the fire and took the lid off. Steam came out, and with it, smells. Grain and root, and a tiny bit of meat smell, almost boiled away. But I was so hungry I snuffed after it. I started to whine, but Heart of the Pack made the eye snarl again. So I went back to the hard chair. I sat. I waited. He took a very long time. He took all the leather from the table and put it on a hook. Then he put the pot of grease away. Then he brought the hot pot to the table. Then he set out two bowls and two cups. He put water in the cups. He set out a knife and two spoons. From the cupboard, he brought bread and a small pot of jam. He put the stew in the bowl before me, but I knew I could not touch it. I had to sit and not eat the food, while he cut the bread and gave me a piece. I could hold the bread, but I could not eat it until he sat down too, with his plate and his stew and his bread.
Pick up your spoon,
he reminded me. Then he slowly sat down in his chair right beside me. I was holding the spoon and the bread, and waiting, waiting, waiting. I didn't take my eyes off him, but I could not keep my mouth from moving. It made him angry. I shut my mouth again. Finally, he said,
"We will eat now."
But the waiting still had not stopped. One bite I was allowed to take. It must be chewed and swallowed before I took more, or he would cuff me. I could take only as much stew as would fit on the spoon. I picked up the cup and drank from it. He smiled at me.
"Good, Fitz. Good boy."
I smiled back. But then I took too large a bite of the bread and he frowned at me. I tried to chew it slowly, but I was so hungry now, and the food was here, and I did not understand why he would not just let me eat it now. It took a long time to eat. He had made the stew too hot on purpose, so that I would burn my mouth if I took too big a bite. I thought about that for a bit. Then I said, "You made the food too hot on purpose, so I will be burned if I eat too fast." His smile came more slowly. He nodded at me. I still finished eating before he did. I had to sit on the chair until he had finished eating too.
"Well, Fitz,"
he said at last,
"not too bad a day today, eh, boy?"
I looked at him.
"Say something back to me,"
he told me. "What?" I asked.
"Anything."
"Anything." He frowned at me and I wanted to snarl because I had done what he told me. After a time he got up and got a bottle. He poured something into his cup. He held the bottle out to me. You want some?
I pulled back from it. Even the smell of it stung in my nostrils.
Answer,
he reminded me. No, no, it's bad water.
No, it's bad brandy. Blackberry brandy, very cheap. I used to hate it. You used to like it.
I snorted out the smell. We have never liked it. He set the bottle and the cup down on the table. He got up and went to the window. He opened it again.
Go hunting, I said.
I felt Night Eyes jump, and then run away. Night Eyes is as afraid of Heart of the Pack as I am. Once I attacked Heart of the Pack, I had been sick for a long time, but then I was better. I wished to go out to hunt, and he would not let me. He stood before the door, and I sprang on him. He hit me with his fist, and then held me down. He is not bigger than I, but he is meaner, and more clever. He knows many ways to hold, and most of them hurt. He held me on the floor, on my back, with my throat bared and waiting for his teeth, for a long, long time. Every time I moved, he cuffed me. Night Eyes had snarled outside the house, but not very close to the door, and he had not tried to come in. When I whined for mercy, he struck me again.
Be quiet,
he said. When I was quiet, he told me,
you are younger. I am older and I know more. I fight better than you do. I hunt better than you do. I am always above you. You will do everything I want you to do. You will do everything I tell you to do. Do you understand that?
Yes, I had told him. Yes, yes, that is Pack. I understand. I understand. But he had only struck me again and held me there, throat wide, until I told him with my mouth, yes, I understand. When Heart of the Pack came back to the table, he put brandy in my cup. He set it in front of me, where I would have to smell it. I snorted.
Try it, he urged me. Just a little. You used to like it. You used to drink it in town when you were younger and not supposed to go into taverns without me. And then you would chew mint and think I would not know what you had done.
I shook my head at him. I would not do what you told me not to do. I understood. He made his sound that is like choking and sneezing.
Oh, you used to very often do what I had told you not to do, very often.
I shook my head again. I do not remember it.
Not yet. But you will.
He pointed at the brandy again.
Go on, taste it, just a little bit. It might do you good.
And because he had told me I must, I tasted it. It stung my mouth and nose, and I could not snort the taste away. I spilled what was left in the cup.
Well, wouldn't patience be pleased,
was all he said. And then he made me get a cloth and clean what I had spilled, and clean the dishes in water, and wipe them dry, too. Sometimes I would shake and fall down. There was no reason. Heart of the Pack would try to hold me still. Sometimes the shaking made me fall asleep. When I awakened later, I ached. My chest hurt. My back hurt. Sometimes I bit my tongue. I did not like those times. They frightened Night Eyes. And sometimes there was another with Night Eyes and me, another who thought with us. He was very small, but he was there. I did not want him there. I did not want anyone there ever again except Night Eyes and me. He knew that, and made himself so small that most of the time he was not there. Later, a man came. A man is coming. I told Heart of the Pack. It was dark and the fire was burning low. The good hunting time was past. Full dark was here. Soon he would make us sleep. He did not answer me. He got up quickly and quietly and took up the big knife that was always on the table. He pointed at me to go to the corner, out of his way. He went softly to the door and waited. Outside, I heard the man stepping through the snow.
Then I smelled him. "It is the grey one," I told him. "Chade." He opened the door very quickly then, and the grey one came in. I sneezed with the scents he brought on him. Powders of dry leaves are what he always smelled like, and smokes of different kinds. He was thin and old, but Heart of the Pack always behaved as if he were pack hire. Heart of the Pack put more wood on the fire, the room got brighter and hotter. The grey one pushed back his hood. He looked at me for a time with his light-coloured eyes, as if he were waiting. Then he spoke to Heart of the Pack.
"How is he? Any better?"
Heart of the Pack moved his shoulders.
"When he smelled you, he said your name. Hasn't had a seizure in a week. 3 days ago he mended a bit of harness for me, and did a good job, too.
He doesn't try to chew on the leather any more."
"No, at least not while I'm watching him. Besides, it's work he knows very well. It may touch something in him."
Heart of the Pack gave a short laugh.
"If nothing else, mended harness is a thing that can be sold."
The grey one went and stood by the fire and held his hands out to me. There were spots on his hands. Heart of the Pack got out his brandy bottle. They had brandy in cups. He made me hold a cup with a little brandy in the bottom of it, but he did not make me taste it.
They talked long, long, long of things that had nothing to do with eating or sleeping or hunting.
The grey one had heard something about a woman. It might be crucial, a rallying point for the duchies. Heart of the Pack said,
"I won't talk about it in front of Fitz."
"I promised."
The grey one asked him if he thought I understood, and Heart of the Pack said that that didn't matter. He had given his word. I wanted to go to sleep, but they made me sit still in a chair. When the old one had to leave, Heart of the Pack said,
"It is very dangerous for you to come here. So far a walk for you. Will you be able to get back in?"
The grey one just smiled.
"I have my ways, Burridge," he said.
I smiled too, remembering that he had always been proud of his secrets. One day, Heart of the Pack went out and left me alone. He did not tie me. He just said,
"There are some oats here. If you want to eat while I'm gone, you'll have to remember how to cook them. If you go out of the door or the window, if you even open the door or the window, I will know it, and I will beat you to death. Do you understand that?"
"I do," I said. He seemed very angry at me, but I could not remember doing anything he had told me not to do. He opened a box and took things from it. Most were round metal. Coins. One thing I had remembered. It was shiny and curved like a moon, and had smelled of blood when I first got it. I had fought another for it. I could not remember that I had wanted it, but I had fought and won it. I did not want it now. He held it up on its chain to look at it, then put it in a pouch. I did not care that he took it away. I was very, very hungry before he came back. When he did, there was a smell on him, a female smell, not strong, and mixed with the smells of a meadow. But it was a good smell that made me want something, something that was not food or water or hunting. I came close to him to smell it, but he did not notice that. He cooked the porridge and we ate. Then he just sat before the fire looking very, very sad. I got up and got the brandy bottle. I brought it to him with a cup. He took them from me, but he did not smile.
"Maybe tomorrow I shall teach you to fetch," he told me. "Maybe that's something you could master."
Then he drank all the brandy that was in the bottle, and opened another bottle after that. I sat and watched him. After he fell asleep, I took his coat that had the smell on it. I put it on the floor and lay on it, smelling it until I fell asleep. I dreamed, but it made no sense. There had been a female who had smelled like Burridge's coat, and I had not wanted her to go. She was my female. But when she left, I did not follow. That was all I could remember. Remembering it was not good, in the same way that being hungry or thirsty was not good. He was making me stay in. He had made me stay in for a long, long time, when all I wanted to do was go out. At that time it was raining, very hard, so hard the snow was almost all melted. Suddenly, it seemed good not to go out. "Baritch," I said, and he looked up very slowly at me. I thought he was going to attack, he moved so quickly. I tried not to cower. Cowering made him angry sometimes.
"What is it, Fitz?"
he asked, and his voice was kind. "I am hungry," I said. "Now." He gave me a big piece of meat. It was cooked, but it was a big piece. I ate it too fast, and he watched me, but he did not tell me not to, or cuff me. That time. I kept scratching at my face, at my beard. Finally, I went and stood in front of Burridge. I scratched at it in front of him. "I don't like this," I told him. He looked surprised. But he gave me very hot water and soap, and a very sharp knife. He gave me a round glass with a man in it. I looked at it for a long time. It made me shiver. His eyes were like Burridge's, with white all around them, but even darker, not wolf eyes. His coat was dark like Burridge's, but the hair on his jaw was uneven and rough. I touched my beard and saw fingers on the man's face. It was strange.
"Shave. But be careful," Burridge told me.
I could almost remember how. The smell of the soap, the hot water on my face, but the sharp, sharp blade kept cutting me. Little cuts that stung. I looked at the man in the round glass afterward. Fitz, I thought. Almost like Fitz. I was bleeding. "I'm bleeding everywhere," I told Burridge. He laughed at me.
"You always bleed after you shave. You always try to hurry too much."
He took the sharp, sharp blade.
"Sit still," he told me. "You've missed some spots."
I sat very still, and he did not cut me. It was hard to be still when he came so near to me and looked at me so closely. When he was done, he took my chin in his hand. He tipped my face up and looked at me. He looked at me hard.
"Fitz," he said.
He turned his head and smiled at me. But then the smile faded when I just looked at him. He gave me a brush. "There is no horse to brush," I told him. He almost looked pleased.
"Brush this,"
he told me, and roughed up my hair. He made me brush it until it would lie flat. There were sore places on my head. Burridge frowned when he saw me wince. He took the brush away and made me stand still while he looked and touched beneath my hair.
"Bastard,"
he said harshly, and when I cowered he said,
"Not you."
He shook his head slowly. He patted me on the shoulder.
"The pain will go away with time,"
he told me. He showed me how to pull back my hair and tie it with leather. It was just long enough.
"That's better," he said. "You look like a man again."
I woke up from a dream, twitching and yelping. I sat up and started to cry. He came to me from his bed.
"What's wrong, Fitz? Are you all right?"
"He took me from my mother," I said. "He took me away from her. I was much too young to be gone from her."
"I know,"
he said.
"I know. But it was a long time ago. You're here now and safe."
He looked almost frightened. "He smoked the den," I told him. "He made my mother and brothers into hides." His face changed, and his voice was no longer kind.
"No, Fitz, that was not your mother. That was a wolf's dream. Night Eyes. It might have happened to Night Eyes, but not you."
"Oh, yes, it did," I told him, and I was suddenly angry. Oh, yes, it did, and it felt just the same, just the same. I got up from my bed and walked around the room. I walked for a very long time, until I could stop feeling that feeling again. He sat and watched me. He drank a lot of brandy while I walked. One day in spring I stood, looking out of the window. The world smelled good, alive and new. I stretched and rolled my shoulders. I heard my bones crackle together. It would be a good morning to go out riding, I said. I turned to look at Burridge, who was stirring porridge in a kettle over the fire. He came and stood beside me.
It's still winter up in the mountains, he said softly. I wonder if Ketrickin got home safely.
If she didn't, it wasn't Sooty's fault, I said. Then something turned over and hurt inside me, so that for a moment I couldn't catch my breath. I tried to think of what it was, but it ran away from me. I didn't want to catch up with it, but I knew it was a thing I should hunt. It would be like hunting a bear. When I got up close to it, it would turn on me and try to hurt me. But something about it made me want to follow anyway. I took a deep breath and shuddered it out. I drew in another with a sound that caught in my throat. Beside me, Burridge was very still and silent, waiting for me.
Brother, you are a wolf. Come back, come away from that. It will hurt you.
Night Eyes warned me. I leaped back from it. Then Burridge went stamping about the room, cursing things and letting the porridge burn. We had to eat it anyway. There was nothing else. For a time, Burridge bothered me.
Do you remember?
He was always saying. He wouldn't leave me alone. He would tell me names and make me try to say who they were. Sometimes I would know, a little. A woman, I told him when he said patience. A woman in a room with plants. I had tried, but he still got angry with me. If I slept at night, I had dreams, dreams of a trembling light, a dancing light on a stone wall, and eyes at a small window. The dreams would hold me down and keep me from breathing. If I could get enough breath to scream, I could wake up. Sometimes it took a long time to get enough breath. Burridge would wake up too and grab the big knife off the table.
What is it? What is it?
He would ask me. But I could not tell him. It was safer to sleep in the daylight, outside, smelling grass and earth. The dreams of stone walls did not come then. Instead, a woman came to press herself sweetly against me. Her scent was the same as the meadow flowers, and her mouth tasted of honey. The pain of those dreams came when I awoke and knew she was gone forever, taken by another. At night, I sat and looked at the fire. I tried not to think of cold stone walls, nor of dark eyes weeping, and a sweet mouth gone heavy with bitter words. I did not sleep. I dared not even lie down. Burridge did not make me. Chade came back one day. He had grown his beard long, and he wore a wide-brimmed hat like a peddler. But I knew him all the same. Burridge wasn't at home when he arrived, but I let him in. I did not know why he had come. "Do you want some brandy?" I asked, thinking perhaps that was why he had come. He looked closely at me, and almost smiled.
"Fitz?"
he said. He turned his head sideways to look into my face.
"So, how have you been?"
I didn't know the answer to that question, so I just looked at him. After a time, he put the kettle on. He took things out of his pack. He had brought spiced tea, some cheese, and smoked fish. He took out packets of herbs as well, and set them out in a row on the table. Then he took out a leather pouch. Inside it
was a fat yellow crystal, large enough to fill his hand. In the bottom of the pack was a large, shallow bowl, glazed blue inside. He had set it on the table and filled it with clean water when Burrich returned. Burrich had gone fishing. He had a string with six small fish on it. They were creek fish, not ocean fish. They were slippery and shiny. He had already taken all the guts out.
"You leave him alone now?"
Chade asked Burrich, after they had greeted one another.
"I have to get food."
"So you trust him now?"
Burrich looked aside from Chade.
"I've trained a lot of animals. Teaching one to do what you tell it is not the same as trusting a man."
Burrich cooked the fish in a pan, and then we ate. We had the cheese and the tea also. Then, while I was cleaning the pans and dishes, they sat down to talk.
"I want to try the herbs,"
Chade said to Burrich.
"Or the water, or the crystal. Something, anything. I begin to think that he's not really in there."
"He is,"
Burrich asserted quietly.
"Give him time. I don't think the herbs are a good idea for him. Before he changed, he was getting too fond of herbs. Toward the end, he was always either ill or charged full of energy. If he was not in the depths of sorrow, he was exhausted from fighting or from being king's man to Verity or Shrewd. Then he'd be into the elf bark instead of resting. He'd forgotten how to just rest and let his body recover. He'd never wait for it. That last night, you gave him carrot seed, didn't you? Foxglove said she'd never seen anything like it. I think more folk might have come to his aid if they hadn't been so frightened of him. Poor old Blade thought he'd gone stark raving mad. He never forgave himself for taking him down. I wish he could know the boy hadn't actually died.
There was no time to pick and choose. I gave him what I had to hand. I didn't know he'd go mad on carrot seed."
"You could have refused him,"
Burrich said quietly.
"It wouldn't have stopped him. He'd have gone as he was, exhausted, and been killed right there."
I went and sat down on the hearth. Burrich was not watching me. I lay down, then rolled over on my back and stretched. It felt good. I closed my eyes and felt the warmth of the fire on my flank.
"Get up and sit on the stool, Fitz,"
Burrich said. I sighed, but I obeyed. Chade did not look at me. Burrich resumed talking.
"I'd like to keep him on an even keel. I think he just needs time to do it on his own. He remembers, sometimes, and then he fights it off. I don't think he wants to remember, Chade. I don't think he really wants to go back to being Fitz Chivalry. Maybe he liked being a wolf. Maybe he liked it so much he's never coming back."
"He has to come back," Chade said quietly. "We need him."
Burrich sat up. He'd had his feet on the woodpile, but now he set them on the floor. He leaned toward Chade.
"You've had word?"
"Not I, but Patience has, I think. It's very frustrating sometimes to be the rat behind the wall."
"So what did you hear?"
"Only Patience and Lacey talking about wool."
"Why is that important?"
"They wanted to weave a very soft cloth, for a baby or a small child. It will be born at the end of the harvest, but that's the beginning of winter in the mountains, so let us make it thick," Patience said. "Perhaps for Ketrickin's child."
Burrich looked startled.
"Patience knows about Ketrickin?"
Chade laughed.
"I don't know. Who knows what that woman knows? She has changed much of late. She gathers the Buckkeep guard into the palm of her hand, and Lord Bright does not even see it happening. I think now that we should have let her know our plan, included her from the beginning. But perhaps not.
It might have been easier for me if we had."
Burrich stared deep into the fire. Chade shook his head.
I am sorry.
She had to believe you had abandoned Fitz, rejected him for his use of the wit. If you had gone after his body, Regal might have been suspicious. We had to make Regal believe she was the only one who cared enough to bury him.
She hates me now.
She told me I had no loyalty nor courage.
Burrich looked at his hands and his voice tightened.
I knew she had stopped loving me years ago, when she gave her heart to chivalry. I could accept that. He was a man worthy of her, and I had walked away from her first. So I could live with her not loving me because I felt she still respected me as a man, but now she despises me.
He shook his head, then closed his eyes tightly. For a moment, all was still. Then Burrich straightened himself slowly and turned to Chade. His voice was calm as he asked,
"So, you think Patience knows that Kedrickon fled to the mountains?"
"It wouldn't surprise me. There has been no official word, of course. Regal has sent messages to King Eod, demanding to know if Kedrickon fled there, but Eod replied only that she was the Six Duchies' queen and what she did was not a mountain concern. Regal was angered enough by that to cut off trade to the mountains, but Patience seems to know much of what goes on outside the keep. Perhaps she knows what is happening in the mountain kingdom. For my part, I should dearly love to know how she intends to send the blanket to the mountains. It's a long and weary way."
For a long time, Burrich was silent. Then he said,
"I should have found a way to go with Kedrickon and the fool. But there were only the two horses, and only supplies enough for two. I hadn't been able to get more than that, and so they went alone."
He glared into the fire, then asked,
"I don't suppose anyone has heard anything of King-in-Waiting Verity?"
Chade shook his head slowly.
"King Verity,"
he reminded Burrich softly.
"If he were here..."
He looked far away.
"If he were coming back, I think he'd be here by now,"
he said quietly.
"A few more soft days like this, and there will be red ship raiders in every bay. I no longer believe Verity is coming back."
"Then Regal truly is king,"
Burrich said sourly.
"At least until Kedrickon's child is born and comes of age, and then we can look forward to a civil war if the child tries to claim the crown. If there is still a Six Duchies left to be ruled."
Verity. I wish now that he had not gone questing for the Elderlings. At least while he was alive we had some protection from the raiders. Now, with Verity gone and spring getting stronger, nothing stands between us and the red ships. Verity.
I shivered with the cold. I pushed the cold away. It came back, and I pushed it all away. I held it away. After a moment, I took a deep breath.
"Just the water, then?"
Chade asked Burrich. And I knew they had been talking, but I had not been hearing. Burrich shrugged.
"Go ahead. What can it hurt? Did he used to scry things in water?"
"I never tried him. I always suspected he could if he tried. He has the wit and the skill. Why shouldn't he be able to scry as well?"
"Just because a man can do a thing does not mean he should do a thing."
For a time they looked at one another. Then Chade shrugged.
"Perhaps my trade does not allow me so many niceties of conscience as yours,"
he suggested in a stiff voice. After a moment, Burrich said gruffly,
"Your pardon, sir. We all served our king as our abilities dictated."
Chade nodded to that. Then he smiled. Chade cleared the table of everything but the dish of water and some candles.
"Come here,"
he said to me softly. So I went back to the table. He sat me in his chair and put the dish in front of me.
"Look in the water,"
he told me.
"Tell me what you see."
I saw the water in the bowl. I saw the blue in the bottom of the bowl.
Neither answer made him happy. He kept telling me to look again, but I kept seeing the same things. He moved the candle several times, each time telling me to look again. Finally, he said to Burridge,
"Well, at least he answers when you speak to him now."
Burridge nodded, but he looked discouraged.
"Yes, perhaps with time," he said.
I knew they were finished with me then, and I relaxed. Chade asked if he could stay the night with us. Burridge said of course. Then he went and fetched the brandy. He poured two cups. Chade drew my stool to the table and sat again. I sat and waited, but they began talking to one another again. "What about me?" I asked at last. They stopped talking and looked at me.
"What about you?"
Burridge asked. "Don't I get any brandy?" They looked at me. Burridge asked carefully,
"Do you want some? I didn't think you liked it."
"No, I don't like it. I never liked it." I thought for a moment. "But it was cheap." Burridge stared at me. Chade smiled a small smile, looking down at his hands. Then Burridge got another cup and poured some for me. For a time they sat watching me, but I didn't do anything. Eventually they began talking again. I took a sip of the brandy. It still stung my mouth and nose, but it made a warmth inside me. I knew I didn't want any more. Then I thought I did. I drank some more. It was just as unpleasant, like something patience would force on me for a cough. No, I pushed that memory aside as well. I set the cup down. Burridge did not look at me. He went on talking to Chade.
"When you hunt a deer, you can often get much closer to it, simply by pretending not to see it. They will hold position and watch you approach, but not stir a hoof, as long as you do not look directly at them."
He picked up the bottle and poured more brandy in my cup. I snorted at the rising scent of it. I thought I felt something stirring, a thought in my mind. I reached for my wolf. "Night Eyes?"
"My brother, I sleep, Changer. It is not yet a good time to hunt."
Burridge glared at me. I stopped. I knew I did not want more brandy, but someone else thought I did. Someone else urged me to pick up the cup, just to hold it. I swirled it in the cup. Verity used to swirl his wine in the cup and look into it. I looked into the dark cup.
"Fitz."
I set the cup down. I got up and walked around the room. I wanted to go out, but Burridge never let me go out alone, and not at all at night. So I walked around the room until I came back to my chair. I sat down in it again. The cup of brandy was still there. After a time I picked it up, just to make the feeling of wanting to pick it up go away, but once I held it in my hand, he changed it. He made me think about drinking it, how warm it felt in my belly. "Just drink it quick, and the taste won't last long, just the warm, good feeling in my belly." I knew what he was doing. I was beginning to get angry.
"Just another small sip, then.
Soothingly, whisperingly.
Just to help you relax, Fitz. The fire is so warm. You've had food. Burridge will protect you. Chade is right there. You needn't be on guard so much. Just another sip. One more sip.
No.
A tiny sip, then. Just getting your mouth wet."
I took another sip to make him stop making me want to, but he didn't stop. So I took another. I took a mouthful and swallowed it. It was getting harder and harder to resist. He was wearing me down, and Burridge kept putting more in my cup.
"Fitz, say, Verity is alive, that's all. Say just that."
"No."
"Doesn't the brandy feel nice in your belly, so warm? Take a little more."
"I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to get me drunk. So I can't keep you out. I won't let you." My face was wet. Burrich and Chade were both looking at me.
"He was never a crying drunk before," Burrich observed. "At least not around me."
They seemed to find that interesting.
"Say it. Say that it is alive. Then I'll let you go, I promise. Just say it, just once. Even as a whisper, say it.
Say it."
I looked down at the table. Very softly, I said,
"That it is alive."
"Oh?"
said Burrich. He was too casual. He leaned too quickly to tip more brandy into my cup. The bottle was empty. He gave to me from his own cup. Suddenly, I wanted it. I wanted it for myself. I picked it up and drank it all off. Then I stood up.
"There it is alive,"
I said.
"He's cold, but he's alive, and that's all I have to say."
I went to the door and worked the latch and went out into the night. They didn't try to stop me. Burrich was right. All of it was there, like a song one has heard too often and cannot get out of one's mind. It ran behind all my thoughts and coloured all my dreams. It came pushing back at me and gave me no peace. Spring ventured into summer. Old memories began to overlay my new ones. My lives began stitching themselves together. There were gaps and puckers in the joining, but it was getting harder and harder to refuse to know things. Names took on meanings and faces again. Patience, Lacey, Celerity, and Sooty were no longer simple words but rang as rich as chiming bells with memories and emotions. "Molly," I finally said out loud to myself one day. Burrich looked up at me suddenly when I spoke that word, and nearly lost his grip on the fine plaited gut snare line he was making. I heard him catch his breath as if he would speak to me, but instead he kept silent, waiting for me to say more. I did not. Instead, I closed my eyes and lowered my face into my hands and longed for oblivion. I spent a lot of time standing at the window looking out over the meadow. There was nothing to see there, but Burrich did not stop me or make me go back to my chores as he once would have. One day, as I looked over the rich grass, I asked Burrich, "What are we going to do when the shepherds get here? Where will we go to live then?"
"Think about it."
He had pegged a rabbit hide to the floor and was scraping it clean of flesh and fat.
"They won't be coming. There are no flocks to bring up to summer pasture. Most of the good stock went inland with Regal. He plundered Buckkeep of everything he could cart or drive off. I'm willing to bet that any sheep he left in Buckkeep turned into mutton over the winter."
"Probably," I agreed. And then something pressed into my mind, something more terrible than all the things I knew and did not want to remember. It was all the things I did not know, all the questions that had been left unanswered. I went out to walk on the meadow. I went past the meadow to the edge of the stream, and then down it, to the boggy part where the cattails grew. I gathered the green cattail spikes to cook with the porridge. Once more, I knew all the names of the plants. I did not want to, but I knew which ones would kill a man and how to prepare them. All the old knowledge was there, waiting to reclaim me, whether I would or no. When I came back in with the spikes, he was cooking the grain. I set them on the table and got a pot of water from the barrel. As I rinsed them off and picked them over, I finally asked, "What happened that night?" He turned very slowly to look at me, as if I were game that might be spooked off by sudden movement.
"That night?"
"The night King Shrewd and Ketrickin were to escape. Why didn't you have the scrub horses and the litter waiting?"
"Oh, that night."
He sighed out as if recalling old pain. He spoke very slowly and calmly, as if fearing to startle me.
"They were watching us, Fitz. All the time. Regal knew everything.
I couldn't have smuggled an oat out of the stable that day, let alone 3 horses, a litter and a mule. There were faro guards everywhere, trying to look as if they had just come down to inspect the empty stalls. I dared not go to you to tell you. So in the end, I waited until the feasting had begun, until Regal had crowned himself and thought he had won. Then I slipped out and went for the only 2 horses I could get, Sooty and Ruddy. I'd hidden them at the Smith's to make sure Regal couldn't sell them off as well. The only food I could get was what I could pilfer from the guard room. It was the only thing I could think to do.
And Queen Ketriken and the fool got away on them. The names fell strangely off my tongue. I did not want to think of them, to recall them at all. When I had last seen the fool, he had been weeping and accusing me of killing his king. I had insisted he flee in the king's place to save his life. It was not the best parting memory to carry of one I had called my friend.
Yes.
Burrich brought the pot of porridge to the table and set it there to thicken.
Jade and the wolf guided them to me. I wanted to go with them, but I couldn't. I'd only have slowed them down, my leg. I knew I couldn't keep up with the horses for long, and riding double in that weather would have exhausted the horses. I had to just let them go.
A silence. Then he growled, lower than a wolf's growl.
If ever I find out who betrayed us to Regal.
I did. His eyes locked on mine. A look of horror and incredulity on his face. I looked at my hands. They were starting to tremble. It was stupid. It was my fault. The Queen's little maid, Rosemary, always about, always underfoot. She must have been Regal's spy. She heard me tell the Queen to be ready, that King Shrewd would be going with her. She heard me tell Ketriken to dress warmly. Regal would have to guess from that that she would be fleeing Buckkeep. He'd know she'd need horses. And perhaps she did more than spy. Perhaps she took a basket of poison treats to an old woman. Perhaps she greased a stair-tread she knew her queen would soon descend. I forced myself to look up from the spikes to meet Burridge's stricken gaze. And what Rosemary did not overhear, Justin and Serene did. They were leeched onto the king, sucking skill strength out of him, and privy to every thought he skilled to verity or had from him. Once they knew what I was doing, serving as king's man, they began to skill spy on me as well. I did not know such a thing could be done. But Galen had discovered how, and taught it to his students. You remember Will, Hostler's son, the coterie member? He was the best at it. He could make you believe he wasn't even there when he was. I shook my head. I tried to rattle from it my terrifying memories of Will. He brought back the shadow of the dungeon, the things I still refused to recall. I wondered if I had killed him. I didn't think so. I didn't think I'd got enough poison into him. I looked up to find Burrich watching me intently. That night, at the very last moment, the king refused to go. I told him quietly. I had thought of Regal as a traitor so long I had forgotten that Shrewd would still see him as a son. What Regal did, taking Verity's crown when he knew his brother was alive. King Shrewd didn't want to go on living, knowing Regal was capable of that. He asked me to be king's man, to lend him the strength to skill a farewell to Verity, but Serene and Justin were waiting. I paused. New pieces of the puzzle falling into place. I should have known it was too easy. No guards on the king. Why? Because Regal didn't need them. Because Serene and Justin were leeched on to him. Regal was finished with his father. He had crowned himself king in waiting. There was no more good to be had out of Shrewd for him. So they drained King Shrewd dry of skill strength. They killed him. Before he could even bid Verity farewell. Probably Regal had told them to be sure he did not skill to Verity again. So then I killed Serene and Justin. I killed them the same way they had killed my king, without a chance of fighting back, without a moment of mercy.
Easy, easy now,
Burritch crossed swiftly to me, put his hands on my shoulders, and pushed me down in a chair.
"You're shaking as if you're going into a seizure. Calm yourself."
I could not speak.
"This is what Chade and I could not puzzle out,"
Burritch told me.
"Who had betrayed our plan? We thought of everyone, even the fool. For a time we feared we had sent Ketrigan off in the care of a traitor."
"How could you think that? The fool loved King Shrewd as no one else did."
"We could think of no one else who knew all our plans,"
Burritch said simply. "It was not the fool who was our downfall. It was I." And that, I think, was the moment when I came fully back to myself. I had said the most unsayable thing, faced my most unfaceable truth. I had betrayed them all. The fool warned me. He said I would be the death of kings if I did not learn to leave things alone. Chade warned me. He tried to make me promise I would set no more wheels in motion. But I would not. So my actions killed my king. If I had not been helping him to skill, he would not have been so open to his killers. I opened him up, reaching for Verity, but those two leeches came in instead. The king's assassin, oh, in so many, many ways, Shrewd. I am so sorry, my king, so sorry. But for me, Regal would have had no reason to kill you.
Fitz.
Burritch's voice was firm.
Regal never needed a reason to kill his father. He needed only to run out of reasons to keep him alive, and you had no control over that.
A sudden frown creased his brow.
Why did they kill him right then? Why did they not wait until they had the queen as well?
I smiled at him. You saved her. Regal thought he had the queen. They thought they'd stopped us when they kept you from getting horses out of the stables. Regal even bragged of it to me when I was in my cell, that she'd had to leave with no horses, and with no warm winter things.
Burritch grinned hard. She and the fool took what had been packed for Shrewd, and they left on two of the best horses ever to come out of Buckkeep stables. I'll wager they got to the mountain safely, boy. Sooty and Rudd are probably grazing in mountain pastures now.
It was too thin a comfort. That night I went out and ran with the wolf, and Burritch made no rebuke to me. But we could not run far enough, nor fast enough, and the blood we shed that night was not the blood I wished to see run, nor could the hot, fresh meat fill the void inside me. So I remembered my life and who I had been. As the days passed, Burritch and I began to speak openly as friends again. He gave over his dominance of me, but not without mockingly expressing his regrets for that. We recalled our old ways with one another, old ways of laughing together, old ways of disagreeing, but as things steadied between us and became normal, we were both reminded, all the more sharply, of all we no longer had. There was not enough work in a day to busy Burritch. This was a man who had had full authority over all Buckkeep's stables and the horses, hounds and hawks that inhabited them. I watched him invent tasks to fill the hours, and knew how much he pined for the beasts he had overseen for so long. I missed the bustle and folk of court, but hungered most keenly for Molly. I invented conversations I would have had with her, gathered meadow sweet and day's edge flowers, because they smelled like her, and lay down at night recalling the touch of her hand on my face. But these were not the things we spoke of. Instead, we put our pieces together to make a whole of sorts. Burritch fished, and I hunted. There were hides to scrape, shirts to wash and mend, water to haul. It was a life. He tried to speak to me once of how he had come to see me in the dungeon, to bring me the poison. His hands worked with small twitching motions as he spoke of how he had had to walk away to leave me inside that cell. I could not let him go on. "Let's go fishing," I suddenly proposed. He took a deep breath and nodded. We went fishing and spoke no more that day. But I'd been caged and starved and beaten to death. From time to time, when he looked at me, I knew he saw the scars. I shaved around the seam down my cheek and watched the hair grow in white above my brow where my scalp had been split. We never spoke about it. I refused to think about it. But no man could have come through that unchanged. I began to dream at night. Short, vivid dreams. Frozen moments of fire, searing pain, hopeless fear. I awoke, cold sweat sleeking my hair, queasy with fear. Nothing remained of those dreams when I sat up in darkness. Not the tiniest thread by which I could unravel them, only the pain, the fear, the anger, the frustration, but above all, the fear. The overwhelming fear that left me shaking and gulping for air, my eyes tearing, sour bile up the back of my throat. The first time it happened, the first time I sat bolt upright with a wordless cry, Burrich rolled from his bed to put his hand on my shoulder to ask if I was all right. I shoved him away from me so savagely, he crashed into the table and nearly overset it. Fear and anger crested into an instant of fury when I would have killed him simply because he was where I could reach him. At that moment, I rejected and despised myself so completely that I desired only to destroy everything that was me or bordered on myself. I repelled savagely at the entire world, almost displacing my own consciousness. Brother, brother, brother! Night Eyes yelped desperately within me, and Burrich staggered back with an inarticulate cry. After a moment I could swallow and mutter to Burrich, "A nightmare, that was all. Sorry, I was still dreaming. Just a nightmare."
"I understand,"
he said brusquely, and then more thoughtfully,
"I understand."
He went back to his bed. But I knew what he understood was that he could not help me with this. And that was all. The nightmares did not come every night, but often enough to leave me dreading my bed. Burrich pretended to sleep through them, but I was aware of him lying awake as I fought my night battles alone. I had no recollection of the dreams, only the wrenching terror they brought me. I had felt fear before. Often. Fear, when I had fought the Forged Ones. Fear, when we had battled Red Ship Warriors. Fear, when I had confronted Serene. Fear that warned, that spurned, that gave one the edge to stay alive. But the night fear was an unmanning terror, a hope that death would come and end it, because I was broken and knew I could give them anything, rather than face more pain. There is no answer to a fear like that, or the shame that comes after it. I tried anger, I tried hatred. Neither tears nor brandy could drown it. It permeated me like an evil smell, and coloured every remembrance I had, shading my perception of who I had been. No moment of joy, or passion, or courage that I could recall was ever quite what it had been. For my mind always traitorously added, "Yes, you had that for a time, but after came this, and this is what you are now." That debilitating fear was a cowering presence inside me. I knew, with a sick certainty, that if I were pressed, I would become it. I was no longer Fitzchivalry. I was what was left after fear had driven him from his body. On the second day after Burrich had run out of brandy, I told him, "I'll be fine here if you want to go into Buckkeep Town.
We've no money to buy more supplies and nothing left to sell off."
He said it flatly, as if it were my fault. He was sitting by the fire. He folded his two hands together and clasped them about his knees. They had been shaking just a little.
"We're going to have to manage on our own now. There's game in plenty to be had, If we can't feed ourselves up here, we deserve to starve.
Are you going to be all right?
I asked flatly.
He looked at me through narrowed eyes.
Meaning what?
He asked.
Meaning there's no more brandy.
I said as bluntly.
And you think I can't get by without it?
His temper was rising already. It had become increasingly short since the brandy ran out. I gave a very small shrug. I was asking. That's all. I sat very still, not looking at him, hoping he wouldn't explode. After a pause, he said very quietly,
"Well, I suppose that's something we'll both have to find out."
I let a long time pass. Finally, I asked,
"What are we going to do?"
He looked at me with annoyance.
"I told you, hunt to feed ourselves. That's something you should be able to grasp."
I looked away from him, gave a bobbing nod.
"I understood. I mean, past that.
Past tomorrow."
"Well, we'll hunt for our meat. We can get by for a bit that way. But sooner or later we'll want what we can't get, nor make for ourselves. Some chade will get for us, if he can. Buckkeep is as picked over as bare bones now. I'll have to go to Buckkeep Town for a while, and hire out if I can, but for now..."
"No," I said quietly. "I meant... we can't always hide up here, Burridge. What comes after that?" It was his turn to be quiet a while.
"I suppose I hadn't given it much thought. At first it was just a place to take you while you recovered. Then, for a time, it seemed as if you'd never..."
"But I'm here now." I hesitated. "Patience," I began.
"Believes you are dead."
Burridge cut in, perhaps more harshly than he'd intended.
"Chade and I are the only ones who know different. Before we pulled you from that coffin, we weren't sure. Had the dose been too strong, would you be really dead from it, or frozen from your days in the earth? I'd seen what they'd done to you."
He stopped, and for a moment stared at me. He looked haunted. He gave his head a tiny shake.
"I didn't think you could live through that, let alone the poison. So we offered no hope to anyone, and then, when we had you out..."
He shook his head more violently.
"At first you were so battered. What they'd done to you. There was just so much damage. I don't know what possessed Patience to clean and bind a dead man's wounds, but if she hadn't, then later... it was not you. After those first few weeks I was sickened at what we had done, put a wolf's soul in a man's body, it seemed to me."
He looked at me again, his face going incredulous at the memory.
"You went for my throat. The first day you could stand on your own, you wanted to run away. I wouldn't let you, and you went for my throat. I could not show patience, that snarling, snapping creature, let alone..."
"Do you think Molly..." I began. Burridge looked away from me.
"Probably she heard you died."
After a time, he added uncomfortably,
"Someone had burned a candle on your grave. The snow had been pushed away, and the wax stump was there still when I came to dig you up.
Like a dog after a bone.
I was fearful you would not understand it."
I did not. I just took Nighteye's word for it. It was as much as I could handle just then. I tried to let the conversation die, but Burridge was relentless.
"If you went back to Buckkeep or Buckkeep Town, they would kill you. They'd hang you over water and burn your body, or dismember it. But folk would be sure you stayed dead this time."
"Did they hate me so?"
"Hate you? No. They liked you well enough, those that knew you. But if you came back, a man who had died and been buried, again walking among them, they'd fear you. It's not a thing you could explain away as a trick. The wit is not a magic that is well thought of. When a man is accused of it and then dies and is buried, well,
In order for them to remember you fondly, you'd have to stay dead. If they saw you walking about, they'd take it as proof that Regal was right, that you were practicing beast magic and used it to kill the king. They'd have to kill you again. More thoroughly the second time.
Burridge stood suddenly and paced the room twice.
Damn me, but I could use a drink.
He said,
Me too.
I said quietly. 10 days later, Chade came up the path. The old assassin walked slowly with a staff, and he carried his pack up high on his shoulders. The day was warm, and he had thrown back the hood of his cloak. His long grey hair blew in the wind, and he had let his beard grow to cover more of his face. At first glance, he looked to be an itinerant tinker. A scarred old man, perhaps, but no longer the pocked man. Wind and sun had weathered his face. Burridge had gone fishing, a thing he preferred to do alone. Night-Eyes had come to sun himself on our doorstep in Burridge's absence, but had melted back into the woods behind the hut at the first waft of Chade's scent on the air. I stood alone. For a time I watched him come. The winter had aged him, in the lines of his face and the grey of his hair. But he walked more strongly than I remembered, as if privation had toughened him. At last I went to meet him, feeling strangely shy and embarrassed. When he looked up and saw me, he halted and stood on the trail. I continued toward him.
Boy?
He asked cautiously when I was near. I managed a nod and a smile. The answering smile that broke forth on his face humbled me. He dropped his staff to hug me, and then pressed his cheek to mine as if I were a child.
"Oh, Fitz, Fitz, my boy,"
he said in a voice full of relief.
"I thought we had lost you. I thought we'd done something worse than let you die."
His old arms were tight and strong about me. I was kind to the old man. I did not tell him that they had. 2. The Parting. After crowning himself King of the Six Duchies, Prince Regal Farseer essentially abandoned the coastal duchies to their own devices. He had stripped Buckkeep itself and a good part of Buck Duchy of as much coin as he could wring from it. From Buckkeep, horses and stock had been sold off, with the very best taken inland to Regal's new residence at Tradeford. The furnishings and library of the traditional royal seat had been plundered as well, some to feather the new nest, some divvied out to his inland dukes and nobles as favours, or sold outright to them. Grain warehouses, wine cellars, the armories, all had been plundered, and the loot carried off inland. His announced plan had been to move the ailing King Shrewd and the widowed and pregnant Queen-in-Waiting Kettricken inland to Tradeford, that they might be safer from the red ships that plagued the coastal duchies. This, too, was the excuse for the looting of furnishings and valuables from Buckkeep,